system. I find you in the shows and moving are great. And being a nerd, there's sign system everywhere you go.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to our space. Today, we're going to be talking about design systems, hiring, design ops, collaboration, as many things as we can pack into a short space of time as possible. I'm joined by Davey Fung, Cobra Dave on Twitter. Davey, would you like to introduce yourself in a tweet-sized format?
All right, perfect. Beautiful. Yeah, hi, I'm Davey Fung. I'm a product design lead here at Meta, leading our business design systems. I'm probably more known to a small audience here for being a co-host on our Design System Office Hours podcast.
Isn't the most popular design systems podcast in the world as well?
Likely the second most popular design systems podcast on Spotify. I could confidently say that.
There we go. All right, let's do it. So we're going to start with talking about careers. And we're going to talk through specifically design systems careers, but we might dip in and out of other careers if we end up getting there. So, Davey, first I'd like to just set the foundation, really, and talk about your design system career, maybe what led you to the point of firstly getting into it. I'm presuming you were always the kind of person who likes taking things apart, putting them together, and systematizing everything. Is that correct?
Yes, I think that's something that my son really loves to do, too, taking stuff apart, trying to put it back together. And I think similar to a lot of product designers that have been around since the aughts, the mid-2000s, a lot of us started off as traditional graphic designers. So that was very much myself working in print design, publishing, that sort of thing. And then as we moved into this, I would say the former Web 2.0 and digital age, we started moving into whatever it was called back then, like UX design, interaction design. And we were always trying to do something very similar for the design system. And it was more leaning towards style guides, managing typography, managing colors. And then as we started getting to these tools that had started to evolve, whether it's Sketch, Figma, XD, you really start to understand that this is, at that point, a newer way to work in digital product design. So my first foray in building this was, I was trying to think back to how far back this was. It was probably around maybe 7 to 10 years ago, working at Goodreads and refactoring a button. And realizing that in the code base, there was dozens of these primary buttons that we had no idea that we had. And it was a little more absurd how many primary brand colors there were as well. There was dozens and dozens, like somewhere under 100. And it was like really about designers and engineers over time, instead of reusing the same component, eyedropping and picking a brand color that they thought looked very similar. You do that and the number of times, and here you are. So from Amazon, I got to join a team at Disney Streaming, and I was one of the first founding designers there, helped leading the design system work there. So that was really my first end-to-end start from scratch. Let's try to build it right, and then let's see if we could get some buy-in to build the team and see how it goes. And then now I've been at Meta for about 1 year.
So this, we're looking about this decade ago when you were tinkering around on what tools were you using to do that?
Oh, that was, I think Sketch was coming there. So that was something, Sketch and Figma were very, very early. So we were in managing like CSS. So that was, I think, just a little bit of a callback to how we had started. Like I had learned very foundational front end. So HTML, CSS, JavaScript. Obviously, none of the JavaScript really held on, but I still remember how to build stuff in HTML and CSS. So we were really working in this very simple code and code snippets at that point. So we were taking stuff into I believe it was probably Illustrator or SketchUp at Pine, and just really trying to simplify however we can.
So you were starting code first at that point?
That was code first, and really trying to understand. At that point, I think Goodreads was around for almost like 7 to 10 years. Also, like it was a really early social media company around discovery of books, and there was years of debt. So we really wanted to understand like how bad was this, and how can we tell this? And it was really trying to tell this design system story of how can we sell getting buy-in to continue to work on this and clean up other parts of the code base.
But when you went from I'm using the word tinkering around, but that's maybe the magic from code first approach, getting them into a tool of choice, building consistency, how did you go from enjoying all these things to packaging yourself up as a design systems person?
That took quite a while. And I think it took working on a specific design system project for some amount of time. So I'm just throwing out time frame. So working consistently on a design system project for 6 months, managing the deliverables from, I would say, the most atomic standpoint, being text, colors, elevations, and then working my way up through influencing how to build other components. So whether they're like button components, detail pages, and then really once I felt that I had that story of building a component library from scratch end to end, that's when I felt like really, this might be a thing that I'm going to attach myself onto for medium term.
So would your advice be for anybody that's kind of at the moment positioned in a company where they are doing these things, but maybe not titled as such, build that portfolio or that case study, if you like, as you're going to the point where you know where the end result is being hired as that position? Is that how you'd advise someone to go around this?
Oh, 100%. Yeah. And I think a little bit of the trap is that when you're starting out, you kind of have to do the work of the role that you want before you get there. So part of my journey at Disney was in order to express that we needed a specific design systems designer and design systems team, even in the future, was looking out in the landscape and seeing what other teams are doing. So that was a little bit of a crawling LinkedIn and looking at lead product designers, design systems, and what does this person do that I don't do? It was like, they manage their own roadmap. Okay, well, I could do that. Like that's not a problem. They manage cross-functional relationships and ceremonies to ensure that designers and engineers are collaborating effectively. Okay, I could do that. So it was really utilizing that almost as like a cheat sheet. And I know some job postings are rubbish. They don't have a lot of detail, but some, depending on if a systems designer had written it, have an incredible amount of detail.
So something I see a lot in job postings generally for like product design positions, is they will include terminology like design systems or component libraries or some kind of words that indicate that job role. What was your perspective on that? Do you think this is a bad thing to be searching for, or do you see that as a useful leverage internally to ultimately converting into that position?
Yeah, I think it's really trying to understand what your leadership is looking for and what might be the trigger for them. So the component library thing, I think, is a very easy one that you could sell. It's like, oh, I'm going to be this person that is going to be managing the component library. I'm going to work with the designers and I'm going to maintain the canon of this and the knowledge on behalf of the team. Doesn't that sound pretty good? So that's one. The other one that is a little bit harder to sell is the inverse of that, building documentation around what is already present. So I would say if I were to be on a team where I'm starting get buy-in and get advocacy, I would say try to do one and a half of these things, whether it's documentation and then component library or component library and
documentation. What does the starting documentation look like to you?
Oh, that's the skipper. So I'll give an example of two extremes. So at Disney, it was a new system, and we are really going from year zero to year two. At Meta right now, we're at 3 years plus. At Meta, there's documentation that is very akin to like what you would see in the Serial or Adobe Spectrum, that sort of thing. Significantly much more scrappy on Disney Plus, where we were building the documentation. What we would try to do is build the documentation in situ in Figma next to the component. So there'd be frames that showed what the components look like, and then we would sometimes show related templates and then link to other parts of the file. So you could really do documentation fairly easy. And this is why I was saying, like, you could do one and a half of these things. You don't necessarily need a doc site up front, but you do need to express how things should be utilized.
Yeah, totally agree. Incremental and upwards, rather than trying to shoot for the moon straight away. All right, let's shift a little bit. We've got something we want to talk about today, which is around hiring. So generally hiring, interviewing are two sides of the same coin, but also, as we're all aware, there's lots of people in the industry currently experiencing layoffs, but there's also a lot of people in the industry just generally looking for jobs, whether they're starters or trying to go up level or upskill or change titles, that kind of thing. So let's just start talking maybe around those topics a little bit. I know you had some personal, some strong feelings around advice to people experiencing layoffs. So maybe we just kick that one off for a start.
Yeah, I think it's definitely, I think in the industry, it's a pretty challenging time with people affected in our company at Meta, and then a lot of friends in the community that have been affected. And there's sort of two sides of this coin where on one end, we don't want to be in the position where we hear from management, like, let's just keep our head down and just turn through it and act like nothing has happened. I don't think that's a very positive way to think about it. But what we've tried to do, or what I've tried to do personally, is aside from keeping myself busy, really trying to hone in on making sure that I'm solving business objectives. So doubling down on making sure that we're tying things back to OKRs. And as product designers come through our support channels, if they need help, making sure that we're available and making sure that we're constantly showing that design systems team members are receptive and are here to help. And I really do think that if you're presenting yourself in the way that you're being helpful and you're not necessarily just being the design system bottleneck, it's going to go a long way and people are going to be able to advocate for you. So it's really about possibly switching more towards the community support model and slowing down some of like the work that we're doing.
So do you think that's been a shift in how people approach design systems generally over the past couple of years?
Yeah, I think in a bit, yeah. The office hours, I think, has been something that a lot of companies have utilized. I've been really trying to get ahead and interject, so to speak, ourselves in the early phases of design discovery and working with product designers. So whether that's like an early sprint or a workshop, really trying to offer our services and let them know that we could probably get you to point A to point B pretty fast if you utilize like our tokens or our components. And I find a little more traction on that right now, but I do still see a little bit of sensitivity with product designers and product owners probably seeing that we're design system designers sort of looming in the background and trying to, critique them like early on. That's not what we're really to do.
So how do we open the door, I guess, to... I suppose it's collaboration, essentially, but there is, as you said, there generally a fear from some people that the people who are looking after the system are there to keep you in check, maybe, or put the rules down. So what advice would you have to somebody who is looking to build more of that collaborative first approach to just, as you said, like building business solutions instead of designing system products?
Yeah, ironically enough, I think there's a method that the thing with office hours YouTube videos that you all do that is a live design component that I found works extremely effectively for my personal office hours, where if the designer has a question, we pull the component and then we really start to detach it, unpack it, and see if we could get to where they needed to go live. And in the past at Dizzy, we've done this live, and we've had multiple designers across other teams also just watching and participating in a more of a, I would say, social manner. And I think if you open it up in that sort of way and make it an experience that's more inviting and more inclusive, where you're co-working with each other versus someone throwing it over the wall for approval, I think that's probably the way to go.
And what if you're in a position where maybe your team is merging with another one, or even your entire company is merging with another one? How do we navigate that potentially disruptive experience for delivering daily work?
Yeah, that one's the harder one that we were unpacking a little bit when we merge the Dizzy Plus team with the Hulu team. And they're still separate brands, but they roll up to the same same manager and same director right now. And one of the major issues was, thinking back then, was there's a lot of questions on, oh, which component library do you use? Do you use the Hulu one, which is in Figma, that's in use for over a year and a half? Or do you use the Disney one that is still being built? And there is a lot of back and forth about which taxonomy should we use? Should we use this one or that one? And I think it's more of a, we had a manager at Disney that I think spoke more about, why don't we just take a step back? I don't like using the word holistically all that much, but let's take a step back and think about this in the holistic point of view and the grand scheme of how might we build taxonomy that works across all three. We don't have to use one or the other, but let's try to see what works for supporting two brands, or possibly in the future supporting three or four or 10 brands.
Presumably you also had work to be doing at that point. You didn't just stop and then have to have these conversations in silo and then continue to work. So you still need to deliver based off what you already had.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And like, we are extremely biased, I think, if you're designing in a certain way. Even like, I would say the thing that a lot of teams have gone through in the past few years, going from Sketch to Figma, for instance, there's a lot of things that we've learned or had to unlearn and really try to be open to new ways of working. So that's I think a big takeaway when merging or combining forces. I like to think of it as we were separate members of the Marvel universe, and we were forming the Avengers.
Very nice. And very marketable.
Yeah, I think that's much more a much better way to think about it, rather than us one team absorbing the other. Like, we're really trying to combine forces to build something that is much bigger than we've ever experienced.
Yeah. So when you start to think about scale and speed and multi-product, multi-brand, all this sorts of thing, that sounds, as you kind of mentioned, big and long-term. And whereas the instinct really is always to think, how can we do the most amount of things in the shortest amount of time? And presumably this means that centrally there needs to be some sort of operational interest and operational drive from the business to solve these things. So that's where I guess the term but design ops comes in. And I know you wanted to talk about design ops more centrally today, so maybe that's a good chance for us to jump over to that topic and start talking about how do you operationalize the merging of teams, libraries, files, code bases, all these sorts of things. Because firstly, it's not easy. Secondly, it takes a really long time. And thirdly, it's going to be different for every single business.
Yeah. And thinking, especially in the age now of automation, like, that is 100% something that could use automation, but does need a human touch, because you do need an understanding of how things are working, let's say, with team A, and how things are working with team B. And I had the pleasure of starting my design systems team under design ops. So we were pillared under design ops for, I would say, 6 to 9 months. And that really gave us the autonomy to propose new ways of engaging with the design system team. So we set up, we were able to set up an end-to-end product design process, which included writing ticket templates for designers. And that may seem like something that's you know, a little bit trivial, but really trying to understand as a product designer, what information do I need to get this task done? What do I need to deliver to engineering or the design system team to continue this on? What steps in the process am I supposed to touch base? And obviously, if the design system team, we're biased, right? We want to be able to get involved in the early stages. We would have a, I don't want to say it's a mandate. It was a strong recommendation, I would say, to touch base with us during your discovery process and attend office hours. So we would have our other program managers that were involved shepherd that work through. So whether it was inviting us to their critique to watch and give feedback or bringing them into our office hours. And that was extremely effective being a part of the design ops.
So you mentioned designers and tickets and management of effectively pipeline, I suppose. That to me is straddling the lines of product management. So where do those lines cross and where do they blur?
Yeah, that's program management, product management, I think blur in this design system world into one specific role. I think very rarely when you're in a smaller design system team, and I say smaller in the sense of you might have 3 to 5 designers, you're not likely to have a specific product manager. Likely the design lead on a team would serve as the product owner, which was in my case, what was going on. Product owner, part program management, and ideally as you were able to scale the team and get buy-in, you would get people in to do the program management. But I would say today at Meta, I don't have a program manager full-time right now. So I'm still a little bit trapped doing a lot of the same duties I was doing in the past with program management.
Yeah, so for a designer, let's take that scenario of a handful of designers working in a team, and that program, project, product, whatever word we want to use, management of the work. How do we deprioritize the pixels and prioritize the importance of the planet?
Well, that's a tough one, because I have strong feelings about maintaining like parity in bulk. So there's a discussion just about if you were to give me a component and you say, let's refactor this table component, for instance, I could continue to refactor this into next year. Because what's going to happen is I'm going to refactor it. I'm probably going to get feedback. And then big one might come out with some new component properties. Let me see if I could wrap my head around simplifying this. And what we're really trying to do is take a step into time boxing as much of the component building as possible. So a specific example last year was at Meta, one of our design system libraries didn't work as intended. So some of the auto layout wasn't working. It had a shit ton of variants, not really organized in terms of, I would say, for someone to really come in and dive into the file. And that's because initially, when we were making the move to Figma, we participated in an open source project that helped feed our React components into Figma. So the stuff was a little bit broken. But we tried to fix it as soon as possible. And we tried to fix it. We tried to understand, like, what can we do in the time frame of 2 to 3 months. We could link make sure all the styles are linked, make sure the component variant menus aren't crazy, make sure things, at least from a frame point of view or a component point of view in the file, we could crawl and we could look at. So separating them by some magic number, 100 pixels, let's just say that. But then after we started doing that, we really tried to understand, let's get some feedback. Let's write some user stories on how users are perceived to be using this. And the big takeaway there was, the broken components was a big factor. But then once we started going a little deeper, we started to understand maybe the variants, we had too many variants on some of our components. Maybe, we needed more examples and references for how these components are supposed to be used. How can we continue to do this work? So then I had to go at that time, it was around the end of last year. So then I had to go into year-end planning and trying to get resources onto how we could do this. And then I would not only mention the user surveys and the data that we pulled, but then also things like detachment rates, like going into the admin panel and explaining, this is where the library was 6 months ago, and this is where we're starting to trend, and then really trying to draw really hypothesis of where this may improve. And then I think a big portion of this, specifically if you're on these leaner teams, is trying to get investment to continue to do this work. So we got some investment to continue this. We have a very small team right now focusing on the component libraries. There's a whole two of us, but we work fast. We prioritize our time very effectively, and like we're just jamming.
Yeah, two people sounds like not a lot for the scale that you're probably working at. So kudos to you for that excellence, I suppose. You did touch on something really, I think, was quite important about refactoring until infinity mode, which is so tempting, because if you don't align to either a deadline or a release or something like that, something metric or dollar driven, then you are just going to be playing around forever. And that's just not a good way to, I guess, feel satisfaction, because you're just kind of working for yourself at that point, and you're not seeing the tangible benefits of that actual thing being released. And the more we play with the pixels in the design tool, I guess the further we're getting away from that business value. So I guess at some point you need to either make a call, or hopefully before that you know what the target is to release before you've even started working on it. And sometimes that might mean that the components just suck a little bit, and that might be fine until the point where they need to be fixed up or refactored or using a new feature. I'm presuming that in your situation, you don't jump straight at new features anyway, just because there's no time. Well, there really is no time to do that yet.
Yeah, so it's so interesting. Yeah, because my previous role at Disney, supporting Disney Plus and Hulu, it was very much day driven and launch driven. So it was, in a sense, we blurred out a day. We blurred out a day somewhere a year ahead of time and say, okay, we're going to launch this in America. Okay, we're going to launch this in EMEA. And then we deal with the consequences and we work backwards. But we don't slip from that day. So everything is spiking and leading up to these specific touch points where we have to get stuff to engineering to do this. At Meta, it's a little different. We're not hitting specific, I would say we haven't worked on much that has hit specific deadline dates. We're really trying to get stuff to designers to start building and to, so they could hit their internal deadlines, but there's no like team-wide mandates that we're working on XYZ feature and we need to get this done all hands on deck. So not yet anyways, but at least for the business design systems team, nothing of that nature. Now there has been some theming updates. So there was like an existing Facebook, I'm using quotations, existing Facebook brand. And then now there's the current Meta brand. So there is an effort to make sure that we're getting aligned into this new company brand. And that's going to take some time. So that might be a milestone that we're going to have to snap a line and enforce a mandate to get people on.
But that would have a clear business objective, right? Where your public perception is driven by the products people are using.
Oh, 100%. Yeah. That is a little fuzzier in terms of like launch date, because it's more of like, well, we do need all the apps to align at some point, like sooner than later. Like we can't be 2 years into a brand update and then have apps that are still falling behind. From like a customer trust point of view, if they see a page that looks extremely outdated, that takes away a little bit of user code.
Yeah, but this even happens within the same products. I think I've logged into like a web version of Gmail at some point, and it still looks like 2011. So I think that these things sometimes can take an entire decade to roll out at that scale.
Oh yeah, like we had internal conversations about like what the fuck happened to Google Drive and what the fuck happened to Google Docs. Like that just flipped on its head like one day a few weeks ago, and I'm sure they worked on that for a long, long, long time. That stuff needs to be done.
Yeah, and I guess the back to maybe the component point a little bit earlier about the slicing it up into maybe more components or less components, depending on what you need. But presumably at that scale, I'm going to try and make one mega Frankenstein component for everything is going to be massively detrimental to that possibility of releasing in one go, or even taking we're going to do a regional launch point. That would be really difficult if you just have one approach to everything.
Oh, I'm glad you mentioned that. So it's in Figma right now, it's extremely easy these days, especially with the new component properties and nested instances feature, to build these Uber components that include slots that are infinitely malleable to be composed in thousands of different ways. Now, we've found that the general product designer doesn't need to be this top 10% Figma user. Mm-hmm. Like, we need to get them to understand how to pull components, how to manipulate them. But if you put yourself in the shoes of a designer that's pulling this, let's say this container component that has a bunch of slots, it would be easy to use from our point of view, because we understand how to manipulate them, how to use the right-hand menu. But how do you make this easy for designers to utilize and just pick up out of the box? And I don't think that we're there yet to be able to build these Uber components. A strategy that we use on our system now is we've gone very wide with subcomponents. So we have subcomponents for most things. So I would say our system has been ready for this nested instance update. We've just been we're very excited. We're not going to refactor until we turn blue, but we have been refactoring in the beta. But one caveat is we've been creating, I hate this term too, sticker sheets, because yep. It sort of diminishes a little bit of the work. But we create composed examples of our components that are common used components and instances. And our rule of thumb right now is if in our documentation site, if there's a code example of this, we have to build the sticker sheet version.
Okay.
So this designers can come and just grab and go.
Sure. And this might be a good jumping off point to talk about the design engineering middle ground process that people struggle with. If you're thinking about the Figma implementation of components, what's your parity like? If you're building or trying not to build mega components, but maybe that is the best way to build it in code, how do you handle that?
That's a tough one. That's at Disney, it was near impossible to build one-to-one components because we were supporting seven-ish platforms. So anywhere from like a game like Xbox, PlayStation game consoles, to Roku, Fire TV, Apple, all of which have different units of measure, different code bases, different languages, that sort of thing. So it was much trickier to say, oh, we're going to have seven doc sites with seven different versions of these components, and then we're going to make sure that we have these coded versions of these. Like, that didn't really work. So there, we put all our eggs in the primitives and tokens strategy and make sure that if we could get X percent adoption on this, so never 100%, but if we could get 80% of this token adoption on these platforms, I think that that's our first way in. And from the meta point of view, geez, it's a little trickier, I would say. I like to think of Figma as the design entryway. So the code is always going to be the source of truth. So my current point of view right now is if we have 10 distinct input components, this is a perfect example. We might have a designer that might come in and say, oh, I could create one input component and wipe away your 10 input components. Like, it's too complicated. Well, our 10 current input components in code are used hundreds of thousands of times across the code base. It's not in our best interest to create this one Uber component. Currently, we need to match code one-to-one. So Figma components are going to be the best representation, I'm using quotation, of what the code should be. And we're going to continue to maintain that until we decide not to. And I think luckily at Meta, the changes in layout doesn't change very often. So the things that change are styles, primitives based on accessibility, brand updates, that sort of thing. So we're in a very good spot there.
Yeah, something I see all the time is that exact scenario of trying to consolidate many different kind of related components into one that can be toggled and switched and booleaned into the stratosphere. And it's, as I said, it's really tempting because we make it very easy to do that. But usage becomes very difficult because you don't know what you can do until you play with all the settings. So I'm very, very much in favor of splitting components, particularly in Figma, splitting them up into visibly different end results that I know what I'm getting. Because if I don't know what I'm getting, I don't know how to customize it to get what I need, to the point where I'm probably just going to create my own version.
Exactly. Yeah. And there's constraints involved, right? So obviously I want to build, if I were starting from scratch, I want to build some flexible stuff that I could make any sort of input with this base input, but it doesn't necessarily need to be that way. One variant that I think is one to think about is error validation, right? So if you had a specific error variant for an error card, you probably don't want to make the icon in there icon swappable, because you don't want a green checkbox going on your error card. You want it to be constrained to the error specific icon. So that is one that I think is vast around the code base. So using variants specifically just to define the constraint of the specific component.
That's quite nice. I've seen you say before as well that designers, it's useful to think tactically like an engineer. What do you mean by that?
This goes far and wide. So this could go into a file hygiene discussion. This could go into how components are composed. But I would love to say that specifically, because we are in the place right now at Meta where we have coded components, it's very easy to understand how components and subcomponents are composed of each other. So we strive to maintain that on the Figma component side. There's no interest in really redoing that unless we are trying to create some new feature Uber components. But even on that end, we need to support things one-to-one. We also try to make sure from a file hygiene, this is just my personal point of view, make it semantically readable. So very easily, like the feature that helped us greatly was after you all helped do stacking orders from top to bottom. I was like, I can make this I can make this file semantically readable now. And other things that we've been doing is just trying to make it easier for designers to see what things are manipulatable. So putting iconography or emojis on editable labels, or putting I love using the ghost emoji for booleans. I'm not sure if people understand that yet. that's a fun one.
Yeah, big fan of emojis in my props at the start to indicate what you do with it. Really nice. All right, let's maybe switch track a little bit. I know you wanted to talk a little bit about training as well, so maybe let's just jump over there.
Yeah, the learning and development, really, I think, is an important one, because there's obviously, like, our tools have changed. And in the course of my career, I've used many different tools. I've used, Photoshop, Illustrator, Fireworks, Sketch, Figma, Framer, all these different tools. So I wanted to understand from you in your journeys, like, how can we get designers to properly get training to utilize systems properly, like the way that they're intended to be built?
Yeah, I think that word you dropped in at the end, intended, is probably the million dollar point there, in that if I don't necessarily know what your intention is for whatever the artifact is, I might not use it in the way that you want, or the way that we want as a team. So my first thing is always open it up. Let me see what's in there. Let me point around, poke around in the system. I'm talking specifically about design artifacts here, and see what's built, what's there, how have you organized it, where do things live, where don't they live, and then provide a space for me to ask questions on that. I think that not necessarily contributing to it and making major changes to things, but being able to have a space where we can talk about it, whether that is in the file or whether that's in a Slack channel or whether it's an email or whatever it is, a place for us to communicate about the things that you're building. So I can just get into your brain a little bit more. I think that watching people talk about things is a lot more engaging than reading somebody write about it. So I saw the Gusto workbench system. They actually have Loom videos to walk you through the files. And I think that is an amazing stroke of genius where you're hearing a colleague, you're hearing their voice, you're hearing the intonation, and them talk through the work they've done. It also kind of gets you in their head, in their zone, because the way that you structure language gives you just little cues about what things mean. So firstly, I think it's about opening those doors and letting people come in. That kind of obviously depends on the size of your system and the size of your team. If it is a 5-person startup, then presumably everybody is contributing anyway. But if it's a 500-person design team, there's probably a centralized team that is managing this. Either way, you've got to communicate between those things. So that education is probably the byproduct of opening the doors. When it comes to the education more formally, I suppose, the teams that I've seen be most successful are the teams that have regular routines or rituals, which is every fortnight we have a office hour session where we talk you through what's going on, what's coming up, how you use things and why they're there. And that is open invite. So even if you're a designer, developer, product manager, whatever, you can come and learn about the system itself. Again, trying to pull down that barrier between who owns it and trying to remove that. We own it. These are the rules. Do as we say, potential problem that we might find. And then it's about telling people what you're working on when it's coming. So in a system that is fast moving, you're probably working on a lot of different things that may not be shipping for quite a while. How do I know about that? And how can I understand that if I have this 10 input component that needs to be 9, that it might not happen for 3 months? And why is it not going to happen for 3 months? What can we do in the meantime?
Yeah, I'm glad I asked that question, because I wanted to personally understand whether, you know, obviously we're doing the right things and what we're doing things that are in the most positive light. So comms is like a big one that you do put a little bit of like the program management hat on. So when we mention comms and what we're doing, that's not only just being strategic about leaving specific notes in the version history of the file so designers can read, because designers don't read when they update libraries. Sometimes they're afraid to update the libraries. We see that. But creating posts, so we have a huge culture of creating, I'd say, medium-ish articles that talk about what we do. And one thing that we've just utilized, Lee, was we don't have Loom, but we just create screenshots of of how some of these new components are working. So I think that's a fantastic idea, recording some voiceover over that just to narrate that and have a little bit of fun.
Yeah.
The office hours thing, I would love to get back to being open.
Yeah, it needs to have the space for it, doesn't it? You can't, if you know, there's always going to be the struggle or the balance between we have 1,000 things to do. Can we afford to take an hour out of those 1,000 things to what might seem for the rest of the business like hanging out with the team? But I think that the longer term benefits of people understanding and using the components or whatever it is that you're building will dramatically reduce the debt that you're creating from people not using it.
Yes, I love that y'all are doing that internally and then externally. So one of the things that have come up, I'm a new mentor on ADP list. I've been talking to a bunch of different designers of all different levels, is continuous training. So one thing that we've pointed to is just maintaining a list of resources as well. So I would say those office hours that you do put on the Figma channel, I think those are great. We've saved a bunch of those just to say. But then how can we get designers to follow along? And I'd say one thing that we did that was a little bit tricky was we postered a design workshop as a Crit item. So we went to a Crit, showcased our components, but then also forced our whole design team to then build and manipulate components so that we sort of tricked them into learning.
Yeah, people learn in different ways. And the way that I've found, sometimes I'll do this workshop with design teams where we build a component live and I'll just watch them build it and then nudge people in directions to say how I would approach it. And a lot of the time that's gone totally fine. But I remember one specific example where nobody was creating them. And I was thinking, oh, what's happening? And I kind of paused and somebody put their hand up and said, can you show us how you would do it first? And then we can learn based off what the quote best practice would be. And I hadn't thought of it like that before. I just assumed that people would be happy to go and play around and learn as they go based off how I learn. And not everybody learns how you learn. So I think that providing a few different options and firstly learning how people want to be taught is going to be enable them to feel confident to do that, because not everybody has the confidence firstly to build components because they can be pretty complex and hard to do. Also to put their hand up and say, I'm not learning this, or I'm finding this quite hard. So creating that space again to accommodate different learning styles is going to enable people to feel successful when they're doing that. But I do genuinely think that giving people the keys to run the session themselves, even if they don't necessarily own the artifact, is going to enable them to have the confidence to learn how to do it. So next week, would you like to run the workshop on creating our message component from scratch? That would then give you the time to prep. You don't have to say yes, of course, but you would be able to approach it in a way that you would to then educate the team on your best practices that then align with the company. And that can be a discussion too. It doesn't necessarily mean what they've created is correct, but you can have that discussion and debate back and forth about, hey, maybe I would wrap this in an auto layout frame, or I would align it like this, or I'd put the padding on this side. Those kind of discussions would enable those documentation guidelines that you want people to read to just be felt and breathed through.
Well, it's about, I think, also being open to the feedback. I think it's sometimes it's your design system's baby, right? Like we've been working on this for so long. We had a specific support question that came in last week where a designer had pointed out that our data viz components don't meet their needs. So then I started looking at the components for bar chart, for instance, and I realized, like, oh shit, we just created all the subcomponents, but we never made a bar chart layout component. Like, okay, this is a great opportunity to let's work with the designer to understand what are the specific components that they want to build, whether it needs to be like completely flexible to the specific container, or they have a specific width. And it would be great for me to reach out to them and do a live design session to really understand what they're dealing with.
Yeah, I think that the challenge would be that you could end up in a situation where you're doing one-to-ones all the time to teach individual specific things to certain people. Whereas you want to get to an environment, I guess, where not that there's necessarily a curriculum, but there is, we're going to talk about this thing next week, come along and learn how to do this together, just so that when somebody does come to a situation where they maybe have to make something similar, they can lean on that experience that you have. That could then become the docs. So this session that you run, although it might be long, it could be recorded and placed alongside your documentation to say, here's all of us figuring it out together. And this is why the left margin is 16 instead of 12. All right. So let's just shift the last maybe 5 minutes to talk about something that you and I were speaking about the other day, which is about systems, design systems, whether people need them at certain scales. And it's certainly a red pepper emoji moment for most people. But I think it's a good discussion to have about what kind of company needs an official formalized design system and what doesn't. I know you mentioned at the start that you kind of found your feet by being a designer who was building these artifacts, and then that kind of realized itself into a more formal design systems role. So at what point do you think that becomes the need for a designer or a team to focus on this in a full-time way?
Yeah, I think a good example would be if other designers are leveraging your work. So if other designers, if you see simply that another designer may need to utilize this frame or this component or this page template, let's try to build this in a fashion that may be reusable by someone else that may not even be in the same product area. So there's the philosophical discussion, right, of do you need a design system? If you're a design team of 1 to 3, maybe not a system, but you can use a library of text or colors or some foundational element. And then as you see, if designers are going to be reusing things from a feature to feature, then I think that might be a line to snap to really try to build stuff in a more systematic way.
Presumably, this is also dependent on what your target is. If you haven't found product market fit, for example, it's probably not the investment to be making right now on reusable component libraries.
No. Yeah. And there's the meta tagline of move fast. But there's another one that's on my computer right now that's focused on long-term impact. So there's a little bit of the delta. You're not going to always be focusing on long-term if you're really you're a Series A startup and you're really just trying to find fit. You're really trying to understand how can I build this as fast as possible. And I would still like to explain that if you do invest in design systems, even if it's someone working on this part-time, you're going to slow down a little bit, but once you start building more and more design artifacts, it speeds you up significantly, right?
So just maybe finally, for somebody who is maybe at that inflection point where they are thinking that, or they can see this need on the horizon, maybe they're rolling out a new product, or maybe there is that merger happening, or there's a consolidation at some point required, what's the thing they need to be doing right now to ensure that slowdown is firstly anticipated, but budgeted for, and then is basically communicated to the rest of the business?
Yeah, it's all about alignment and trying to be consistent across different products and surfaces. So if you have two different brands that are coming together, how can I find consistency amongst their tight ramp? And whether it's just picking one or the other, I mean, that's a suitable approach too. But maybe you could commingle them together and come together with something that works for both. So really trying to take not the 10,000 foot approach, but the 1,000 foot approach and understand how you could build things that are reusable across.
Great. That's a lovely place for us to finish. Thank you so much, Davey. Hope you've had fun. And thanks, everybody, for listening.
Thank you so much.